Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Renee Powers here. Thank you so much for your patience while we took some extra time off from the podcast. I decided to take a few extra weeks beyond what was planned in order to revisit and make some changes to this show. You see, as Feminist Book Club has grown, my time has gotten more and more scarce. Plus, this podcast was never intended to be just the Renee show. So with that said, I will be inviting more voices onto this show in the coming months. The format will change as well. In addition to the interviews that you've grown to know and love, you'll hear book discussions, recommendations, reviews, news, and conversations with other book lovers. It will truly be the one-stop shop for all intersectional feminist book chat. If you have suggestions or requests for upcoming content, you know where to find us. hello@feministbookclub.com or DM us on Instagram @feministbookclubbox. And until those new episodes are in the works, you will still be getting regular author interviews while we work on those next steps. And you may even get multiple episodes a week. So you do have lots of good stuff to look forward to, and I thank you for your patience. Today's episode is such a delight. I hope you've seen Maika Muli and Maritza Mulit's new book, One of the Good Ones, on Instagram, because it is getting a great amount of buzz, and it is all completely deserving. I had so much fun recording with these sisters and learning about their writing process, about their approach to the book, and trying to talk around a twist and spoiler. It is hilarious and, you know, just what happens when you talk about books, but it is spoiler free. And if you haven't picked up this book already, it is out and it is ready for you to read. All right, everyone, enjoy. Hi, everyone. We've got a treat for you today. Today, I'm talking with Maika Mulit and Maritza Mulit. They are sisters and co-authors of the young adult novel, Dear Haiti, Love Elaine, and the forthcoming One of the Good Ones, which I just devoured. Maika is a Miami native and daughter of Haitian immigrants. She earned a bachelor's in marketing from Florida State University and an MBA from the University of Miami. When she's not using her digital prowess to help nonprofits and major organizations tell their stories online, she's sharpening her skills as a PhD student at Howard University's Communication, Culture, and Media Studies program. Her research focuses on representation in media and its impact on marginalized groups. She is the eldest of four sisters, including Maritza, and loves young adult novels, fierce female leads, and laughing. And Maritza graduated from the University of Florida with a bachelor's in women's studies and the University of Southern California with a master's in journalism. She's worked in various capacities for NBC News, CNN, and USA Today. Maritza is a PhD student at the University of Pennsylvania, exploring ways to improve literacy in under-resourced communities after being inspired to study education from her time as a literacy tutor and pre-K teacher assistant. And her favorite song is September by Earth, Wind, and Fire. We're recording in September. It's a great time for it. It's in my head now. Well, I mean, the two of you, hi, welcome. Is there anything you can't do?
Sleep.
No kidding.
I am not very good at swimming. I like scammed my way into like passing a swimming class without knowing how to swim. So I will offer that. Hi.
Hi. Well, you're a couple of women after my own heart. I did my PhD program in communication as well. And
love it.
Master's in journalism and communication and bachelor's in women's studies. So
oh my gosh, we're like meshed together.
We're all the same person.
Right. Except you are writers and I am not. I am just here to ask you questions. And that's my segue. We start the podcast with the question, what does it mean to you to be feminist? And Maritza, I'll start with you.
Yay. Okay. So not that I wrote this down or anything. Feminism is the belief and call for the equality of women and other marginalized genders in all facets of life, and the acknowledgement of the intersectionalities of these oppressed groups in various ways based on other aspects of their identities.
Spoken like a true women's studies alum.
Thank you.
Maika, do you have anything you'd like to add to that definition? Or your own
Twitter? No, really. I honestly was like, ooh, Marissa, I wanted my definition to include intersectionality. And Marissa was like, every definition of feminism should include intersectionality. And I was like, you're damn right. So here we are.
If it's not intersectional, it is not feminism.
Amen.
Correct.
Well, let's level the playing field here for all of our audience who have not read this book yet. Can you give an overview of what One of the Good Ones is about?
Yes. So, when 18-year-old Kezi Smith is killed under mysterious circumstances in police custody after attending a social justice rally, her loved ones are left reeling. So, to commemorate their history buff sister's life, Happy and Jenny decide to embark on a journey using Kezi's heirloom copy of the Negro Motor Screen Book.
And we like to say that it's a cross between The Hate U Give meets Get Out, and it explores sisterhood and how trauma manifests itself even generations later. And hopefully it'll leave readers wondering and questioning what it truly means to be an ally, because we talk about a few things throughout the book and we're really excited for it.
Yes. Yes. And this book is, I mean, timely. Unfortunately, it will probably continue to be timely for some time, but it's also just really, I don't want to say a fun read, but a gripping read. It's one of those that keeps you, I mean, I sat down in two sittings and finished it and just powered through because I didn't want to put it down. So I want to talk about some of your approaches to it, because on paper, it sounds like it's another quote unquote issue book, right? That this is about police brutality. It's about the death of Black women in police hands. And it is that, and it's so much more. Can you speak to that?
Yes. So when we sat down to write One of the Good Ones, it was over a year ago. So it was before this summer of racial reckoning that we've been having. And we kind of went into it knowing that we wanted to tackle this because we had a very specific thing that happened to us. So our grandma's older sister, Tunt Moon, we affectionately call her, she passed away, an older woman, and she was sick. And, it was the day of the funeral. We get to the cemetery and we're looking at the mausoleum walls and we're going through some of the names, and very near to where our aunt is buried, we came across Trayvon Martin's tomb, or, you know, his mausoleum. And it just was a full circle moment, because at one point in time, Marissa and I are the two oldest of two additional women, so it's four sisters, and we're obsessed with them. And when we came across, you know, his spot at the cemetery, it just stayed with us, and it's always stayed with us. And part of that is because one of our younger sisters went to school at one time at one of the schools that he went to school. So it was always this thing where we didn't know him personally or his family, but he very much lived in our Miami, you know, the Miami that is, you know, it might have a lot of Black people, a lot of Caribbean people, you know, the multicultural Miami that we think of. But it just really stuck out to us. And in that moment in time when he was murdered, it just stuck with us. And we wanted to unpack that, but we wanted to do it in a way that tackles what it means to be Black in America. But for us, since we are the eldest of four women, we specifically wanted to narrow in on that experience of being a Black woman in America. And through One of the Good Ones, we are able to tie in just the legacy of trauma, honestly, that exists for Black people generationally in this country. And it was our attempt to be able to unpack that and to show how something that we say, oh, that happened so many years ago, can still manifest itself today, and how it impacts you. And, it was a labor of love, but it was still a labor. Like, it was very hard for us to write this story, but we hope that at the end of it, people will really take away what it means to be an ally. When you say that you are an ally to someone of a marginalized group, does that mean that you say, yes, I'm your ally, you are this one person that I love and we'll have our individual conversations? Or do you call out those injustices when they are happening in real time? You know, so we hope that that's what people are able to take away from reading One of the Good Ones. That was a little long-winded, y'all.
No, I liked it. I've written about this elsewhere, but I've always said that to be an ally is not passive. It's not a label you can give yourself. It's something that is bestowed upon you based on your actions. And we see allyship happening and doing of allyship in One of the Good Ones, and doing it maybe not the best way as well, too.
Right, right. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about this legacy of trauma you brought up, Maika, especially for Black women. And how did you address that in this book?
So this is Maritza. Okay. Yeah. So,
really quickly, we do this thing where we try to let one person take a question and the other take a question.
I love it.
So you'll just find us automatically answering the other person's questions. Don't worry about it. It's just something we do. But go ahead.
I just assume it's like sister ESP or something.
Telepathy.
Yeah. There it is. Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, when we first started coming up, when we first came up with this idea, I will speak for myself and say that I had just recently heard of the Negro Motor Screen Book. Maika will tell you that she knew about it long before me, but I had never heard of it. I wasn't surprised that such an item would exist, that Black people in the past would have needed a guidebook to tell them where they would be welcomed and feel safe. But it still was sad to learn that it existed, if not surprising. So that was just such a fascinating artifact for us, and we really wanted to incorporate that in our story. And we decided to do that by including some characters that lived in the past who have close connections to our characters in the present day. And it was so easy to be able to tie in things that would happen historically to what is happening now. Like, we were able to talk about World War II and desegregation of schools, and hopefully not make it seem like a history paper or something. But like, it was just so easy to do because these things are so important to us right now. But yeah, and we felt like it was incredibly important to show how the things that you might be dealing with in your day to day that seems so very individual and personal to you, they are that, but then there's so much more to that. There are like thousands and millions of people that are that you can look back to who have experienced things that are similar to that. And hopefully that gives you strength to be able to push through, but there's so much tying us together.
Yeah. And to kind of piggyback off of what Maritza was saying, when she says that it was easy for us to make that connection, it's not that it was, you know, easy for us to sit down and grapple with all of these hard truths. It's just that so many of the things that were happening in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, earlier are still happening today. And it just reinforces that idea, really, that time is cyclical. It's, we keep repeating the same things. And very much, especially this summer, it feels like, you know, that we're failing an open book test. We know how this played out during the civil rights era, right? And here we are again, having these conversations where people are questioning like, well, do Black lives matter? We know that they do, point blank. So in us writing this book, it was kind of, you know, it could be a little disheartening, really, when you think of it, how so many of the parallels that we were drawing with things that happened in the past happen in the present day. And although our characters are all fictional, these things were really happening. We were going through so much research and finding all of this historical evidence of these stories that we were able to tell. And it's disconcerting, really, like I said. But like Maritza also mentioned, there's hope in that, because we have to acknowledge that things have gotten better. Even though we are still experiencing the same things over and over, it's slightly different now. We have more ability to talk about things. We have social media where we're able to shed light on conversations that we might have been having privately, but now we're able to have them on a national, international scale. So we hope that One of the Good Ones really does that well and shows that juxtaposition about things that have happened before, things that are happening now, and might even continue, honestly, till to continue, because we see it playing out even now.
I was surprised when I read, you've got an author's note at the very beginning, and I think I got this book, I think I have a obviously a advanced reader's copy because it's not out till January.
Yeah.
I was surprised to see references to George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. I don't know how to ask this question. I was just wondering, like, at what point do you say this book is done? Because it seems like maybe you went back and added names and added references, and it's not technically out till January, and God forbid something else happen, is that going to get incorporated?
Exactly. That's exactly what we had to do. You finish the book after a zillion rounds of edits amongst ourselves and then with our editor, and then you send it, and then they, you know, are going to print some arcs, and then all this stuff happens. And then, like, we felt it was so important to put the names of the people that we're even talking about right now. And we will never stop talking about Trayvon Martin or any of the other many countless individuals who we don't even know about. These are just the people that were on camera or, like, have some type of notoriety because of something else. Like, there's so much that we don't even know that we don't know, but we felt that it was important to include the people that we're talking about right now, the ones that have newly died, who have died for the same reasons that countless other people have lost their lives over, this injustice, and the fact that it continues to be fresh and continues to be new. And it is so unfortunate that, like, it seems like a given that even by January, when it's too late to do any type of updating and the book is done and out, but the topics that we're discussing in it are going to continue to persist and be so relevant. Yeah. Like, in my class, we had to read the Kerner Commission from 1968, and they were asking, what's up with all these race riots? What's going on? And Lyndon Johnson was like, can you figure this out? And then they did. And they basically were like, yeah, it's because of racism. And the way that the report describes what was happening, like these uprisings that were happening in various major cities around the country, it was like not just one big thing that happened, but so many small, medium, big events that are kind of heightening the awareness and the sensitivity of the people living in these unjust environments. And then people have to react. They have to say something and fight back. And that's exactly what's happening right now. And it's so crazy that that was 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah. And when we were going through our edits, we hadn't included those names, obviously, because crazy to think about, at the time of us writing it, these people were still alive. So we wrote this story, of course, not being able to see in the future. And I think a lot of times people talk about things, especially books that are dealing with Black justice, and they're like, oh, it's ripped from the headlines. It's like, no, this is ripped from our everyday life. Like, this is happening. And I think because of the pandemic, and everyone is basically forced to stay at home if you're adhering to social distancing guidelines, you can't turn away from the television. The distractions that we had in our everyday life, where we might have been able to say, wow, that's a terrible thing that happened, I'm going to go to brunch. Now you aren't able to do that the same way. So you see that terrible thing happens and it sits inside of you and it's percolating. And you're like, what can I do with this energy? I'm not going to be dropping the kids off at school. I'm not going to be going out to, you know, a networking event. All of the things that you would have been able to do to then take your mind off of it, you can't. You're stuck and you are forced to deal with it. And it's very heavy to unpack. And when we were writing the author note, of course, we didn't mention those names because they were still alive. And then we were going through the editing process, and it was like every few weeks we had to add another name. And it just got to the point where we were like, we have to write a line that says, and to all the people that we don't know, or something along those lines, just to show that this is an ongoing issue. And I hope that when people read one of the good ones, they don't think, wow, this book is great. I learned something. It made me feel things. And then they put it down and they go on with their lives. We want people to feel motivated to action, for them to look at what they can do, even in their day-to-day lives, to make a change. And a lot of times when we talk about people who consider themselves allies, they say that they don't feel comfortable speaking up, you know, to their family members or coworkers or people who are close to them when they're saying hateful things. But I think it's in that moment when your voice is shaking, when you're speaking to someone who you know and you love, that is so powerful. Because I feel like a lot of times, like, we've had marches, we've had scholars and people going on television talking about this and the impact that it has on people now, today, tomorrow, forever. But the change, I think, happens when people have these conversations amongst themselves, when someone who looks like you calls you out on your behavior towards someone who does not look like them. So, you know, it was a really, really strange phenomena for us to be able to write this story and then continually be adding those names in it. And it just got to the point where we had to say, you know what, we have to let it stand the way that it is.
I'm struck by the title too, One of the Good Ones. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yes. So the title, One of the Good Ones, first of all, we're terrible at titles. Honestly, we can't, it's not our forte. So we honestly, when they announced this book, it was like untitled YA novel. And we were calling it our Green Book book because we didn't know what to call it. But then through our story, early on in the first edits, we used the phrase One of the Good Ones because Happy was talking about her sister Kezi, who had been killed under mysterious circumstances. And she said that people would call her One of the Good Ones. And our editor saw that and she was like, that really sticks out to me. And we went back and forth with it internally because we were worried that people would see the title and know all of the heavy connotations that come with it and think, oh, this book is a book about, you know, it's elevating that idea of you needing to be a certain type of Black person for people to care. But what we wanted to do is, like, throughout the story, we have lots of people using the phrase One of the Good Ones. And it's in relation to race, it's a relation to sexuality, it's in relation to so many different things, but it was important for us, for people to see the ways that we use it and how it can be harmful. And I think, you know, if the person takes the time to look at the back of the book or the end flap or wherever it is going to be, and they see two Black women wrote it, they're going to be like, okay, hopefully we'll give them a little, a little wiggle room and let me read this book to find out what it's about.
Yeah, we are first generation Americans. Our parents are from Haiti, and we've grown up just constantly hearing that you have to try your best, you've got to talk a certain way or study a certain subject or work really hard, and hopefully that'll protect you from everything. And the more that we've grown up and the more that you have just, I mean, it's impossible to not realize at this point, but we realize that none of that stuff, this idea of respectability, is going to save you from the systemic injustices that are embedded in our society. So it's important to speak up and point out that it's not just the college-educated, Ivy League-educated, fancy professional person who deserves to catch a break and not die at the hands of police or some random vigilante on the street. It's everyone. It doesn't matter what the background is. Like, as a human being existing in the world, you have the right to just exist and feel safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, what's more respectable than sleeping in your own bed at night and then still having police officers come in and kill you? What's more respectable than sitting on your couch after a long day of work eating ice cream and, you know, an officer who says they were walking into the wrong home shoots you dead? Like, respectability does not save people. It doesn't. It's honestly, like, once you, it might make you feel good about yourself because you're kind of feeding into this idea of what the world values. But you know that when I step out and somebody sees me, they see a bald Black woman. That's what they see. And that comes in with so many different things. You know, the fact that I have no hair, someone might think, oh, is she sick? Oh, is she militant? Oh, is she this? Oh, she's Black. You know, it, like, all comes together for people to make their, you know, preconceived ideas about who you are. So, yeah, I mean, it it's something I think a lot of people would be better served if they learned that respectability doesn't save you. And a lot of times in the ways that we like to police people, especially women and our bodies or people who identify as women, like none of that is going to save you. You need to be who you are and accept you for who you are. Because when you step out into the world, someone's going to have whatever idea they have of you regardless. So you might as well be true to yourself.
Yeah. And one of the good ones, this phrase, it has precedence too. And it's referenced at one point. Kezi is a history buff. And I think they're referring to her love of history. And honestly, like, this is my blind spot too, is I don't remember her name. But Rosa Parks had a precedent.
Claudette Colvin
sat where she shouldn't, quote unquote, shouldn't, on a bus, a Black woman. But we don't hear her name until a lighter skinned woman who didn't have a child out of wedlock, right? Mm-hmm. Rosa Parks. That's the name that history remembers because she is, quote unquote, one of the good ones.
Exactly. Right. And I feel like part of that is the powers that be within the civil rights movement really feeling the need to try to remove as many quote unquote barriers as possible. A teen mother, someone who is darker skinned, a whole bunch of other things, they felt that people wouldn't listen to that or would think that she deserved whatever disrespect came her way, versus another woman who was more involved in the movement and looked a certain type of way and was much more respectable, they thought that that would be a better look. And ultimately, they were doing the same thing, calling for the same thing, respect and justice. But it's hard. And I mean, it's everyone who needs to do a better job of trying not to place values or judgments on other people's existence, marginalized or not.
Yeah, I agree. They were just trying to make what they thought would be more palatable to white people. But I think there's also something to be said when within the community, we elevate certain people who look a certain way, who have a certain education, who go to certain schools, have certain jobs. And I think the fact that we're able to readily remember Rosa Parks, which there it's not to discredit her. Like, she sat on that bus. She was asked to get up. She didn't. Like, she did that. But to completely erase someone who did it first, and why, that takes a lot of self-reflection. And I think especially if we are talking about, you know, dismantling, these are the words that I'm learning in my PhD program, but dismantling the imperialist, white supremacist, racist, et cetera, society that we live in, we have to then take that time to do self-reflection. Like, how am I upholding these values and the things that I do? How can I make sure that I am doing my part to level the playing field, to allow somebody who does not have maybe the same means or same opportunity to be elevated to a certain status and not be ridiculed once they reach that level of elevation. So, yeah.
I'm going to switch gears, not because I don't think this is important, but because there is so much to get to. This book is written in multiple points of view by two authors. So are those two things related? Does one of you write from one perspective and one of you write from other perspectives, or do you both write from all points of view?
Yeah, we write from all different points of view. All of the characters end up being our babies, even though I don't really consider them to be babies, but you know what I mean. But yeah, we have a really extensive outline where we put everything or most of the things that are going to go in our story. It'll be like 15 pages and we know like this will happen there and that'll happen then. And we use that as the jumping off point because we do leave time and space for the spirit to move us when we're writing. But when you're writing with two people, you kind of have to have a roadmap of where we're going so we can work at the same time as well. But I think what we just like doing, and maybe it is because there are two of us, we just like writing about different people, like going into so many different people's minds and thinking about their motivations. And we tend to, and by tend to, I mean, we only have two books published, but we tend to incorporate characters from the past to kind of speak to where current characters are or give a reason or background into what's happening now, or that connection that we were talking about earlier. But yeah, it just ends up being just a web, a dance full of people that you have to kind of make sure you know where everyone is. But it's fun to do. I think it makes for a more fun process.
Yeah, and we don't ever split it out by character. It's so strange. Like when we wrote our first book, Dear Haiti, Love Elaine, we both would just jump in like, do you want to write this part? Okay, great. Do you want to write this part? Okay, great. And then we would just write whatever we want to write. You go back and you read what the other person wrote, and then you inject your own points and things throughout. So that way it sounds like one cohesive person, you know, wrote it. And for one of the good ones, we had multiple points of view, and it never occurred to us like, okay, Maritza, you could take this person and I'll take the other person. We were just like, all right, so today I'm writing Kezi and next you'll write Jenny. And we just kind of, you know, did it that way. And it's probably a testament to like the sister's telepathy that we kind of talked about, but also like our parents were super strict growing up and we weren't really like going out and having a whole bunch of friends and doing things. We stayed home or went to church a lot of times, and it was just the four of us. And when I say the four of us, I mean me, Maritza, and our two younger sisters, Jessica and Lydianne. But it's like we've developed our own language in speaking with each other. And it's easy for us to be able to fill in the gaps when one of us might not necessarily know, like, oh, I don't know what I want to do, or just talking to the other person will help bring something to life that we might have been stuck with. But yeah, but that outline really is, it plays a crucial role in us being able to make sure that we know where things are headed. But I was very against that outline because I'm a pantser. I am like wanting to feel inspired and all of these things, and it just doesn't work. You never feel inspiration all the time. So if I'm waiting for inspiration to write, it will literally take me like 10 years to finish one book. And we don't have time for that. So
we need you to write more and more. Please don't take 10 years for your next one either. Make no mistake, audience. This is a thriller. It doesn't sound like it. I promise you there is a twist. Who got to write that? Who came up with that twist? And we're not going to have any spoilers, but can we talk around it a little bit?
Yeah. Okay, trying to talk around it. Basically, we knew we wanted certain things to happen. And it was very important for us to make sure that that thing happened. And we needed a way to have that occur in a way that made sense. This is very...
Folks,
we're like talking
it
around. Right. It's like, this is a donut and the inside of the donut is this, it's from Knives Out. Yeah, we just knew that there was something that we wanted to do, but we couldn't figure out the way to do it. And especially when we talk about books about racial injustice, there, you know, we had that in the back of our mind as we were working through it. So what we'll say is that when you get to that point, you could tweet us and then we could be like, yeah, you got it. And then we'll go from there.
I love that. And why did you decide to go down the thriller route with the rest of it?
I think it was because for what we wanted to happen, it just made sense. And I think that we just like to write things and we didn't want to kind of put ourselves in one box. So we pull from genre and different types of, that is what genre is, isn't it? But we just pull from different genres and do what we want to do and what we think is best for the story. And it was definitely a challenge for me to be able to do something, to write in a way that I hadn't before. It's just fun to grow and like kind of push yourself in that way as a writer, just artistically. So yeah.
And we knew that we wanted it to have like beautiful language. So throughout the novel, we were very intentional about the way that we would describe things. And we were like, oh, let's put our fancy schmancy literary hat on. That was literally what we went into when we sat down to write. But then there's something to be said when like you can feel that shift in tone happening gradually because our sentences get shorter. They get quicker and the pace of the story picks up. And that's intentional. We want that moment of like, okay, things are happening. You sense something strange is going on, and then it just picks up. And then all of the points start to come together. So that was really important to us. And like Marissa said, we were totally stretching some muscles that we didn't realize that we had. But our editor really did a great job of giving us feedback and helping us to really bring out what we wanted to bring out of the story. So shout out to Natasha Wilson.
Thanks, Natasha. No, I definitely felt that pace pick up. I read the first 100 pages in one sitting and then the 300 plus rest. Like, I have to finish this tonight. It is so good.
I'm so happy to hear that, because I was just reading this book for class and I literally let myself take a nap after every 10 pages.
Been there. Academic writing.
Yes, exactly.
Nap inducing for sure.
Yes. I was joking with my sister. I said it's like Mojo Jojo from Powerpuff Girls, but in academic writing, it's terrible. Yeah.
Well, I can imagine that that's another muscle that's nice to stretch out, is your fiction writing. I mean, that's why I founded Feminist Book Club, honestly, is because I was so tired of reading academic texts. I needed something fun.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And so you get to write those fun things in addition to writing all of your, you know, super smarty pants PhD work.
Balance.
She does the dance. I love that.
Yeah. It's fancy.
That's her smarty pants dance.
Well, we are coming to the end of our time, which I could talk to you both forever. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much. We do end with the same questions, and I will ask each of you, Maika, if you have a book to recommend that is not one of your own, what would you like to recommend to our audience?
Yes. So I would recommend Wings of Ebony by J.L. It hasn't come out yet. I'm reading the advanced reader copy. And Tiffany D. Jackson described it as like magic in the hood. And I think it's a perfect example of this. And really, I want more stories like this, where you don't have someone who's like fancy, quote unquote, schmancy, talking about what we talked about in terms of respectability, but just an everyday person being able to find the magic within them, literal or figuratively. I'm sold. So that's what I'm reading right now.
That sounds beautiful. And then where can we find you online if we want to connect further?
Yes, I'm Maika Mulit everywhere. And if you search or Maika and Maritza, then you'll come across our website or our Facebook page.
And Maritza, you have a book recommendation for us?
Yes, I do. So I would recommend Now That I Found You by Christina Forrest, because I love everything that she writes. And it is just a fun, like, romp through New York City, where the main characters are trying to find Evie. Evie's the main character, her grandmother, who's a fancy schmancy actress who goes missing. And it's just a love letter to New York and a romance, which I love. And it's so fun. And I think that everyone should read it.
And where can we find you online?
Maritza Mulit everywhere.
Awesome.
I'm right behind you right now. Don't look.
Terrifying. But wonderful. I would welcome that, actually. Let's have some margaritas and call it a night. Well, this has been such a joy. Thank you so much for joining me. I will put links to One of the Good Ones, to Dear Haiti Love Elaine, to the books that you recommended and your social media in the show notes. So go check them out. Make sure you get this book on your radar, everyone. I'm predicting a few months early, there's going to be a lot of buzz around it once it hits publication. So
yay. From Renee's lips to the universe.
That's right. I'm speaking that into existence. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you
for having us.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. chest.